All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to reconvene. If you could all take your seats and finish the subcommittees, we will get to the real committee. Our next speaker this afternoon is Robert Sweezy. Rob is the president of Adventist Risk Management and all the related insurance companies owned and operated by the General Conference, which insure many, if not all, of your institutions around the world. Rob has been president of Adventist Risk Management for the last 16 years, and until recently was my boss. I couldn't say bad things, but now I can say all kinds of bad things. But I won't. Rob is a lawyer by training, has an MBA, and is currently working on his doctorate in business, which he hopes to complete soon enough. But in that meantime, he has been learning an awful lot, and he's here to share some of that knowledge with us this afternoon. Rob?
Thank you. Well, in the next few minutes, we're going to talk about board governance and maintaining an effective board. We have talked so far about conflicts of interest, a subset. We've talked about leadership, and this is the leader. And this is where conflicts happen. So we're going to talk about how to make a good board and how to make it strong. If you see the paper, let me suggest that perhaps the best part of the paper is the bibliography. And I would encourage you to take a look at it and read some of the other articles and material there. You'll find one book in the bibliography as well as a number of journal articles. But the book by two British researchers leading the board, The Six Disciplines of a World-Class Board Chairman. I highly recommend it. A very unique approach in much of the literature, and I would encourage you to take a look at their academic research and thought. The research and the paper is based on American and British research on boards, and I hope today you'll see some principles that apply across the globe. Again, let me say that this whole series came out of numerous conversations with Adventist hospital administrators across the world, so we have also attempted to answer some of the challenges that we heard around the world. I have an acquaintance who was chairman of the YMCA Service Corp in the United States for years. And he made a statement that is very pertinent to our discussion. And he said it this way, in terms of risk management, the genesis of every accident begins in the boardroom. The genesis of every accident begins in the boardroom. The boardroom is where, for my profession, safety starts and where great organizations are born. So everyone here is a member of a board? Yeah, I think it's probably so. How many of you are members of a great board? How do you know it's great? How do you measure greatness? Well, There are a number of organizations around the world who do that. And you can read about them in the popular business press, and they give awards to the boards who have succeeded. I refer to one in the paper from an organization in Singapore that rates boards. When they look at the boards, they look at five things. First, they look at the structure of the board. What's the structure of your board like? Well, what are we talking about when we talk about structure? Let me suggest we're talking about the committees, the processes, and how the work is done in the board. It talks about style. They want to know how the board works. What is its personality of the board as a group? They want to look at the meetings. What do you do there? How long do you do it? What is your meeting like? Is it a pleasant place to attend? Is it a place where business gets done? They look at members, and I'm going to spend some time talking about board membership. And they talk about, fifthly, not on the screen, productivity. What do we mean when we talk about productivity of a board? You ever think about, I've sat all day and kept minutes and wasted hours? What do you do in that time in the board that when you're done, you can say we produce something? In most business literature, when we talk about productivity, we're talking about competitive advantage. Does the board add to the firm's competitive advantage? And how do you measure that competitive advantage? In the commercial world, we'll usually talk about competitive advantage being those things that allow us to sustain the business into the future. Do we make profit today? Do we own intellectual or other special assets that help us compete? What competitive advantage do we have to put us into the future? How does your board, your great board, give a competitive advantage, or how is it productive for your institution? Those are questions that we need to ask. Well, when we look at the board and say, what makes your board great? And I've identified five things that one organization in Singapore, anyway, rated a board for greatness on. You will say, well, my board's different. That doesn't apply to me. My board's a hospital board. My board's a nonprofit board. My board's a church board. What makes your board different? Well, in the literature, particularly the American literature, not as strong yet in the British literature, there is a growing distinction between for-profit and not-for-profit. When you look at the for-profit literature, the things you should do are rather clear and uniform throughout the literature. When you look at the nonprofit literature, it becomes confused and muddled. Let me suggest that the reason it becomes muddled on the nonprofit side is that the literature is not correctly divided. That is, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit in America is simply tax status. And tax status isn't an operating difference, or shouldn't be an operating difference. And in fact, when you take the nonprofit literature and separate the type of organization the research was done on, you will see that if you divided that material between organizations who survive and whose future depends on charity, that is, gifts given to the organization, versus organizations who have to earn their profit and their income and their future, it becomes very clear. And those who have to earn their future, i.e., an American hospital, who, while it may receive some gifts, has to earn most of its income, really falls into the same desire determinants that a for-profit organization has. So what a world-class board for an institution, even a nonprofit church institution that has to earn its income today and into the future, needs to look like is much the same as a for-profit corporation. As we are looking at Adventist hospitals, my belief is most of them fall in that category as opposed to ones who survive on charity. So we will follow throughout the paper the determinants as outlined for a for-profit organization. Well, who is the board and what do they do? Well, there's probably three distinct things that a board has to do. Let's see if I can make that right. That's not where we want to go, so we won't go there. Three things. Number one, give a clear mandate to management of what they are to do. It is the board who is to direct the CEO and the management in a clear, decisive way. Number two, give clear support for the organization. Nothing is more discouraging to a CEO and more destructive to an organization than a board that doesn't support the organization. I know of one university, sadly an Adventist university, where the chairman became disgruntled with the theology department. But instead of changing the department, he went about his union disparaging the institution. You can't have the leadership disparaging the institution. Back to Dr. Clark's point of being the great salesman. Not only goes to the CEO, it goes to the board members. Clear mandates, clear support, clear vision, and a clear grasp of reality. So the board must understand those four things. The primary role of the board has to do, as when we looked at leaders, has to do with the future. Not today, not the day-to-day. It has to do with the future. And the board, every day, every time it meets, needs to talk about where this organization is going to be in the future. The day-to-day job is management's. Let me talk about the board members being in tune with mission. There was a time when conventional thought was that board members shouldn't serve on too many boards. I've heard it talked about in the church about conflict of interest because they serve on two different church entities that somehow somebody thought they competed. The General Conference has answered that question. They don't compete. We're complementary. We have one mission. We've heard in the public sector that the board member doesn't have time to serve on too many boards. Well, the fact is you may limit the number of boards, but you still don't know where that member is spending his time or how much time he is spending on the board. The current literature would indicate that being a board member is an acquired skill, and you acquire the skill with practice, through doing it, through a knowledge base, cognitive additions. And so service on more boards actually improves the performance. It is, of course, at the board where separation of ownership from management takes place. And in that regard, a clear mandate, a clear distinction between management and ownership takes place. Now, in many of our organizations, as in other nonprofits, both charities and those who have to earn it, have a board full of volunteers. It is particularly challenging for volunteers, a particular danger, that they will abdicate their role to management. That cannot be allowed to happen. One way you prevent that is by not allowing employees to be on the board or have a vote on the board. The research is becoming quite clear on that point, that employees should not have votes on the board. Well, let's talk about what happens at the board meeting itself. Members have three key functions. One is service, that is to help the organization. They do that by bringing their knowledge base, speaking for, being salesman for, being strategist for the organization. They bring control to make sure that conflicts of interest and other abuses do not take place by management. And, of course, they have the strategy. Where is this thing going to be in the future? To accomplish those three goals means you must have the right members at the board. Now, I want to talk about diversity, because diversity needs to be addressed in two different areas. Frequently, we in the church address diversity when we talk about race, gender, nationality. We heard that issue raised once before. And those members at the table bring different perspectives and different thoughts. But in the extreme, 10 conference presidents from 10 different nations who all went to the same school and received the same education sitting on the board only bring a very little bit of difference in perspective to the board. The board needs not only that national origin, gender, etc. diversity to have different views on the board, but the board needs a set of skills. You need a lawyer. You need an accountant. You need a preacher. You need an engineer. You need to assemble a set of skills that are pertinent to the strategy of that organization. Interestingly, one researcher pointed out that while you did not want your medical committee to be your board, you did want one physician at least on the board if you have a hospital. You need someone representing that skill set. Think about your institution. Think about what complementary set of skills you need on the board so that you have both a diversity of skills and that knowledge base that comes with those professions, as well as the diversity of nationality, gender, race, etc. A complementary set on the board. That doesn't happen by accident. Those skills that are needed have to be identified, selected, recruited, trained as board members. Well, so now you've got the right players there. Let's look at what happens at the board meeting. And this really comes down to the job of the chairman. What is the chairman going to do? Number one, he has to have an infectious passion for the organization. We are not here because we have to be. We are not here because somebody's got to take care of this mess. We're here because we have a passion for the mission and strategy of this organization. And that needs to be shared infectiously with all the members. It needs to be a can-do attitude, one that sets a tone of how important it is, of what is going to be done there. Chairman needs to acknowledge the diversity. Having different nationalities sit at the table, having doctors and lawyers sit at the table, brings an interesting mix and an interesting climate to the table. Those need to be identified, acknowledged, spoken about, and encourage the various views that come as a result so that the best answers, the best strategy, can be brought to the table for the organization. As those diversity meets, there will be a certain chemistry that has to be nurtured so that teamwork will continue to be fostered among those that are there. Don't forget that element. Delineate the strategic responsibilities. It's important for the chairman to remind the board members of what their job is, and he probably needs to do that each and every time. Not only to keep them focused on the job and away from pettiness and day-to-day management, but also to keep them away from the conflicts of interest. He needs to remind them each time of their job. Must canvas reality. Must remind the board members of the weaknesses and the challenges faced by the organization and the opportunities that are thus available. Must build a consensus of what reality is. We have so often don't want to deal with reality. We want to deal with the positive and the happy, but we have to deal with reality also. Review the progress. You know, organizations have histories. And if you're always dealing sometime in the future, it's always good to keep the overall term in perspective. Where has the organization been? What have the trends been lately? What do we expect for the future? We've been dealing with this problem for four board meetings now. In the first board meeting, we identified it and said our reality was this. We set this course of action. These are the results of our actions that are happened. This is the reality today. What action do we need to take tomorrow on this problem? Put the thing in perspective. Review the timeline. Review the process. Review the challenges. Encourage feedback. You're obviously going to have, because of the differences in personalities, members who like to talk and members that don't. All board members are equal. All board members' opinions are important. All board members should be heard. And if they're not speaking up, they need to be drawn out. If they're speaking up too much, they might need to be pushed back. And it's the chairman's job to make sure that all board members are equal. That's particularly challenging in some of our boards, where, as we talked about earlier in the yesterday, about so many of our board members being there ex officio. And sometimes it's hard for a pastor or a teacher to remind a conference president or a union president. But when they're at the table as a board, they need to be equals. Let me say on the side that what happens when you have a board member who misbehaves? The answer is they're a board member and the board's responsible. Karnick talked about conflict of interest. Another duty of the board member is not to disclose private information or information about the organization, to hold it in confidence. What happens when they do? Is the any and every board member's obligation to remind them not to. What can't happen is the chairman sidelining that board member. You may want to go back to the appointing body and ask that they be removed, but you can't sideline them. They are a member, they're all equals. Limit the damage. Sometimes in the heat of battle, tough things get said. And in fact, tough things need to be said at the board. But we need to make sure when the board is over, we're still all a team. And the chairman needs to attend to the team. So, in sum of the board meeting, chairman needs to set the tone, set passion for the organization. Well, hard and dirty work, the work of the board, tough stuff. She should expect some divergence of opinion, as we said, but most importantly, we must create a culture that is willing to question, willing to ask the tough questions, define reality correctly. One who's not afraid to put each other or management on the spot. One that's not afraid to use experts such as auditors, lawyers, actuaries, engineers, whatever your particular board calls for, and to ask them the tough questions. We just completed a Gen Con Insurance Company of Vermont board, and the outside auditor was there and pointed out some things that he thought weren't correct. They had been there for many years, however. He'd never pointed them out before. And I appreciated one board member who said, "What about that, Mr. Auditor? What about that?" Don't be shy. Ask the tough questions. If you don't ask the tough questions, you won't understand reality. You won't be doing your job of controlling. The chairman has to break down the argument, keep the argument about the issues and not about personalities, and encourage the constructive, challenging debate. And us lawyers would call it argument and would be fine with that. How do you do this? Break it down. Keep focused. Members are equal. Limit the agency cost. Agency cost is a term that refers to cost added to the organization by those who work for the organization. You don't want to increase the cost of your auditor, of your management. You want to keep those overhead costs down. And when you fail to break down and have the diligent argument, you will end up increasing that agency cost. So, creating and growing a strong board becomes the duty of every member and the chairman, and it takes time. It takes time to be a board member. I think it is scary sometimes when you look at union presidents in particular. And I've said the research supports being on multiple boards, but you've got to dedicate the time to do it. It can't become a win or lose situation between individuals. It takes time. So let's talk about growing the board a minute. We talked about skills. Although some of the resources vary, anywhere from 10 to 40% of the board's time needs to be spent on education and building group skills. 10 to 40% in the literature. You need to take time on the board to attend to growing the board. Whether that be their duties as board members, insights into the type of organization that they are governing. I think one of the mistakes we make as Adventists is that we assume that the management of a conference, of a hospital, of a food factory, of a other type of institution, a printing house, is all the same. And there are subtle and very distinct differences that if we don't understand, we will have less than excellence. So take time to educate them individually. Take time to educate them collectively. In the paper, you will find an example of an assessment tool. The board members need to be assessed, and they need to be assessed not by management, not by someone they supervise, but by the chairman and or each other. They need to be assessed individually. They need to be assessed collectively as we look at their tools, tool set. The next question is, how do you grow future board members? One way to do that is to invite prospective members to serve on some of the board committees. When you do that, you need to pay attention to the skill set you're going to need long term, i.e. lawyer, doctor, engineer, actuary, etc., so that you have the right people at the right time, because you're not going to need very many of any given skill set. The other thing I noticed, and I didn't address it in the paper, but the other thing we notice is the size of boards. And in the literature, although I didn't address it, it varies again tremendously. But as a general rule, most of our boards are way too big. I've actually seen posted in denominational documents where the board is meeting, but you all don't need to come. Clearly, the board's too big. Because if you all don't need to be there, you probably don't need to be on the board. So we need to get the boards down to workable sizes and make them and let them work. Okay? I want to take just a moment and talk about ethic. Dr. Andreessen talked about ethic. Karnick talked about ethic. The reputation of the organization will not be greater than the reputation of its board members. So when you have board members who are known to be unethical in their personal life, the organization will take on that reputation whether or not it really is. It's important to select board members who will enhance the reputation of the organization. It's important for the organization of the board to police each other to protect its own as well as the organization's reputation. Nothing takes longer to build and is destroyed quicker than a reputation of an individual or an institution. It's important work that must be attended to even by secular organizations. So in conclusion, it's a complex task, and it is getting more complex. If anything is reality in the current economic crisis throughout the United States and Europe, is that there will be greater demand for lawyers, more government intervention, more government action in the lives of our public institutions. That is going to make the task more complicated each and every day. It's going to require greater skills, knowledge, and ability of our board members. So growth is the key. Remember that a strong board is really only needed in a tough time. But it can also only be built in an easy time. Kind of like the seven fat cows and the seven skinny cows. Start fattening them up now because the tough times are coming and you'll need a strong board in a turbulent time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. For a response, we have asked the individual who chairs probably the most complicated and complex boards within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Elder Lowell Cooper, to come and provide a response. Lowell?
Thank you, Karnick. Maybe I just should say that I chair the boards of complex institutions. I don't chair complex boards. I just didn't want you to walk away with maybe a misinterpretation. But thank you, Rob, for a presentation that I think is vital in any forum of denominational leadership. And as I look around the room, I see quite a number of people that spend a good deal of their leadership time in meeting configurations of boards or committees. There are a lot of things that we can disagree upon in an Adventist meeting, but I think it would not take long even in this particular meeting, for us to reach virtual unanimity on the assertion that when it comes to governance and governance functioning in our denominational structure, it is a matter that is understudied, undersourced, and therefore underperforms. So I'm really glad to see that the topic has been placed here in, you know, in the list of all the other important things that we're talking about at this conference. We rely on board and committee structures at every expression of organizational life, from local church to General Conference Executive Committee, from local church school to the largest of institutions that we might have. Peter Drucker, I think many of you will recognize his name, reached a level of international recognition because of his study and insights into management and governance. There's an interesting statement that he writes in one of his books. He says there is one thing that all boards have in common. They do not function. I hope he said it somewhat tongue-in-cheek. And yet, it wasn't just as a joke that he made that observation. He does acknowledge the difference between for-profit and not-for-profits, but it's interesting that there's a lot of commonality of things to be addressed. And his statement, I think, rests on the idea, the recognition, that when it comes to governance, the opportunity for leadership in the life of an organization is greatest at that point. But the development of capacity for leadership is often the weakest at that point. And so I think that kind of a realization underscores the importance of the presentation that we've heard this afternoon. I'm sure you yourself, Rob, would recognize it is only introductory, because I know that you can drill down on a number of those areas in ways that would be very, very helpful to all of us. Let me see if I can just recapture, maybe in slightly different language, the overall points that Rob was making. The first being to think about the role of a board, that of being governance, not management. Perhaps you have also seen that in the life of institutions and organizations, just as there is a law of gravity that says this paper clip will fall if I let it go, and it did fall right into a crack that I hadn't known was there, so I can't hold it before you. But this pen is going to be subject to the law of gravity. There are certain laws that operate in board structures and committee functioning, and that is, there is a drift, unless it is resisted, there is a drift from governance towards management. That tendency to drift needs to be resisted. And I think that was a point that Rob's the presentation was trying to underscore, that we need to know there's a difference. First of all, to know there's a difference between governance and management, and to be able to draw those boundaries and to respect them in the life of the board. The second thing that I heard is board composition. That is a very important aspect to keep in mind. How do you structure the members of a board? Even on a church board, But even if we could say more so at an institutional level, how do you structure, how do you get skill sets that match the range of governance responsibilities that the board has? I believe while we can take this presentation as a general approach to governance, I think we also need to recognize that within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we have a few special challenges along the way. And that is our tendency to structure a lot of boards and committees with ex officio membership, not necessarily skill-based and skill-representative membership. This is not to say that we should not have ex officio members, that we should not have people who are church leaders on our boards and committees. But it is to say that once we have looked at that type of composition, we also ought to study whether or not there is sufficient skill set and range of skills represented in those kinds of members, and if not, to find other ways of getting that on the board. The third thing that I heard in the presentation was the matter of board competency. This is beyond skill set. It's board competency. That is the ability of the board members who now have the responsibility of governance to bring not only their skill set and information, but their understanding of the environment of the institution into play when they are in meeting. And good emphasis was given, I believe, it cannot be overemphasized, the importance of board education as individuals and as a group. It is a discipline that Rob, as president of Adventist Risk Management, practices at every one of our board meetings. He makes it sure that there is a time of board education. Collectively, he has also made sure that there's opportunities for board education as individuals. We have come to the place in some of our boards where one of the requirements in recruiting board members is to say that part of your responsibility in the period in the term that you serve on the board is to attend off-campus, off-site board member education. There's a requirement. It's not onerous, but it is a requirement. And I think it underscores what Rob has cited as indeed a fundamental issue in governance. Looking at composition, looking at competency, the last thing that I would say to summarize his presentation, then I would like to make three comments about perhaps ways in which we might amplify the considerations that have been presented. But the fourth thing is dealing with board dynamics. What happens in meetings? He identified a number of problems that could occur or a number of things that should occur. It may be helpful for us to recognize that good social dynamics on a board or committee do not automatically happen when you get good people in a room. Good social dynamics is a result of very intentional practices of leadership. They do not happen automatically. You may remember the Enron Corporation. You know, that just one of the biggest corporations in the world, and then just suddenly overnight ended up in bankruptcy. Someone from Harvard decided this would be a wonderful thing to study. Why did this happen? And so he did a research project about it, studied some things about the Enron board. The Enron board was composed of very, very eminently qualified people, bankers, lawyers, accountants, investment specialists, and leaders, captains of industry, and so forth. It was a 14-member board. It had a good size. And thanks for mentioning the issue of size. We're overweight in denominational boards. Enron board had a good size, 14 members. This person interviewed board members of Enron and asked, you know, how could it happen? Here's a very good board, very competent people. How is it possible that one of the best boards that you can imagine didn't see what's happening in the company? And the interesting thing is that as he interviewed the individual board members, these were people at the height of their careers and their expertise. But they confessed to this interviewer, we didn't understand the financial statement. We assumed that other people on the board did. And so we didn't talk about it on the board. Rob pointed out the issue of dynamics and what happens in the meeting, that you have to get a climate where people can challenge assumptions, where it is safe to talk. Creating those kinds of dynamics takes intentional effort, and particularly, I think, on the part of the chair. Maybe that's a whole different seminar. But thank you very much for that introduction to a very, very complex and important topic. Could I suggest maybe three things that perhaps from a Seventh-day Adventist church standpoint also need to become part of the discussion? The first thing is that we look at the difference between the executive committee structures that we use in the church and the board structures that we use in institutions. There is a difference. And many of us live in both, you know, both expressions of governance without really understanding the difference. The difference, as I see it, as brief as I can say it, is that in the executive committee structures of the church, we do not have the court of last appeals. You know, the conference is related to the union to the division to the GC. There is, a 3 or 4 step relational process going here. At an institution where we have a board of trustees, that's final. The board is responsible. You can't take the board issue and refer it to the conference committee. And we don't always realize that when we inhabit these two different kinds of expression in governance. That, I think, would be an important distinction to make in the future. I appreciated that much was said, and with the appropriate emphasis, about the board's role in mission and vision. That is so vital. I think we need to add to that on the other end of it the board's responsibility to establish benchmarks and dashboards by which it monitors progress. Frequently, that is not done. Boards meet almost with the understanding that everything on a 13-item agenda has equal importance. It doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. The board ought to identify the few things that are going to be the things that it requires reports and information on, because these will measure the trajectory and the momentum of the organization in the accomplishment of its mission and vision. Lastly, I noticed, I didn't see it in the paper, but I saw it on the slides. I hadn't seen the slides ahead of time, and they interleaved very nicely, and I think added some dimensions to what I saw in the paper. But I think the question ought to be raised about whether or not we use committee structures in boards. Emphasis was given to the importance of what transpires in a meeting and the necessity of having good discussion and the challenging of assumptions and the examination of information and so forth. Sometimes I think that's very difficult to accomplish in the boards we have. There's another rule about boards, and that is the larger the board, the less the discussion. At least the less the substantive discussion. And so it may be in the institutions we serve, and I, th- I think we need to realize that there's not one pattern that fits every place. But when you have a large board in a complex institution, you may need to think about the wisdom of placing some of the board responsibility into appropriately structured committees that can drill down with more depth and more discussion and analysis than is available to the board itself. I believe that Seventh-day Adventist organizations ought to be the best-run organizations in the world. I believe it is possible. But I believe also we have a ways to go to get there. And this presentation today was a good start. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elder Cooper. Before you get too far, you might as well come on back down. The next segment of what we're going to do this afternoon. Yes. Oh, sure.
On the question of the chairman of the board, I notice in various committees that the role of the chairman is most of the time to facilitate, to keep the things going and get the conclusions and the final vote and have it recorded and so on, make sure that everybody's on board as has been presented today. I also notice a great difference in how much the chairman speaks on the board. In some committee, he's only the facilitator. He only speaks and clarifies and is there for that purpose. In other committees, the chairman is speaking all the time. How much should a chairman speak? And if he wants to speak, should he hand that over to somebody else?
Yes.
I think that it's not important how much he speaks. It's more important how and what he speaks. Clearly, the chairman needs to speak enough to set the tone, needs to speak enough to make sure that all members are equal, needs to speak enough to make sure that all the members understood the financial statement, needs to speak enough to make sure that questions or decisions of the board are well thought out and plans are well placed. So a lot of the speaking may be in forms of question. I do not believe it is inappropriate for a chairman to talk to board members and committees prior to the board to influence the outcomes. So I don't know, you know, some of them feel strong, I'll let Lowell come up and answer also. I think it's more of how he speaks than how much.
I once sat on a board, come on down, Lowell. I once sat on a board where the chairman would get so emotionally involved in discussing the issues to the point where he made himself ineffective. I think if a chairman is going to be that involved in the debate, he needs to step aside, because you really can't chair a meeting and at the same time advocate a position.
Thank you very much. I was going to comment on this, and I thought, well, I'm taking too much time. But that's, again, a difference between the committee structure and the board structures we have in our institutional, in our organizational environment. Generally, on the executive committee, the chair of the board is also the president of the organization and is an advocate, you know, of a particular approach to an item on the agenda. Generally, in our institutions, the chair is not the head of the institution. In fact, I don't know that we practice that anywhere. And so the role of the chair in the institution can be somewhat stepped away from advocacy of the management position. And I think that that kind of chairmanship is easier. It's more difficult in an executive committee when you are both the advocate and the chair of the meeting. For the role of the chair in speaking or not speaking is really to create some of the social dynamics there that enable good discussion and good decision making. And if you are too much invested in the outcome of the thing, you may not be able to spend your time in creating the social dynamics that are necessary.
Perhaps I have a bias, but having always worked on the institutional side in the church and never worked on the executive committee side, and I strongly agree with Lowell that too often in the church we don't understand the distinction between the two styles and types of management and governance structure. And for that reason, maybe I don't fully appreciate the issue you raised, Johann. As I do not chair my board. Bob Lemon chairs my board. My board expects, I believe anyway, management to have positions on issues that are brought, and management, I and my VPs, expect to be questioned and probed on them.
There is also a challenge because probably the way the church runs its operations versus the status of the hospitals, which have to generate their own income to pay their way. And then, when it is run like, we just get money from tithe, you don't have to think as to how you are going to generate that money. It proves to wrench in some cases, whereby one, a plan, a project, you are thinking because there is a competition out there. The world is changing. You have to think fast. You have to implement the things in order for you to survive. The situation is no longer like it used to be. Probably new hospitals have mushroomed, and there is stiff competition. Now the board comes to sit. You have to wait for the chairman who is in the U.S. visiting these places. You cannot compete, that type of thing, and it is proving to be a challenge in that case. And the project is not voted. Second thing, the role of governance versus management, not being separated. You are tied. Your hands are tied. Down there as a manager, you can't do this. So you're controlling two variables, in this case, governance issues as well as management issues. You can't employ this doctor. It is like a challenge in this case. You need him in order for you to progress. Now they ask you for your head at the governance level.
Let me address two points I'm hearing real clear. Number one, what type of governance do you need? Let me use Brother Clark down here as an example. Brother Clark will take all the charity anybody will give him, but he earns his income. Most of his income, his survival, his future, depends on patient revenue. So. The board needs to function in that model, not in the model of where they receive everything. Now, one of the things we heard loud and clear around the world, especially in the developing nations, when we visit our hospitals, is a confusion between whether they're charity-based or income-based. That is a question that the board as to clarify. The board has to set the mission. The board has to set the strategy. Once they set that mission and strategy, then they need to request from appropriate authorities the governance structure that matches the mission and the strategy, number one. Number two, There is a clear, I'll repeat again, both Brother Cooper and myself, a clear distinction between governance and management. Adventist Risk Management has, what, 120 employees plus or minus? I don't call my chairman when I want to hire somebody, except for one of the four vice presidents. My board doesn't hire, doesn't fire, doesn't pay, doesn't promote employees. That's a management job, not a governance job. The fact that Mr. Limit is somewhere else in this world almost every day doesn't confuse the clear mandate, the clear mission statement, the clear statements of the expectations of Adventist Risk Management's management team. So let's find that line, define that line, and resist, as Elder Cooper said, the tendency to drift.
I knew this topic was going to bring more frustration than we already have in this line. It's nice to see how you went through all the key issues that we're dealing with. I'm coming from an institutional point of view, of course. And you touch very strongly on the issues of employees not sitting on a board, for instance, which is not understood in most places where we go, where you see all, I want to know, when you say employees, do you include the leadership of the institution, for instance, taking the institution? We have our idea about that based on research that it is a conflict of interest for them to have a say, I mean a vote. So in many of our boards, the leadership sits as permanent invitees with voice but not vote.
Let me clarify that and then yes. I'll let you go on, Doctor. And understand that the governance structure at Adventist Risk Management, I've been there 16 and a half years. I did not create. I inherited. But I think the forefathers were very wise. If you have a lot of employees on your board, you're going to confuse and drift that line between management and governance. And you need that line. Example, Adventist Risk Management has a board of about 15 members. They're appointed by the General Conference Corporation. I am, as the president, the only board member. The other four vice presidents are invited and I assume are given voice, although you don't hear much from them except when they're presenting or when they're on the hot seat answering questions about their issue. And clearly for compensation, for audit, I leave the room. It is not a management or employee-run organization. You've got to keep that bright line, and that too is one of the clear distinctions, I believe, between institutional board and the executive committee structure.
This is absolutely clear, and it clearly shows the confusion that we have between, as you put it there, ownership and management.
Yeah.
Ownership and management. This is completely blurred in a church structure. It is part of most of our policies at certain levels. You touch on the matter of chairmanship, ex officio. Those issues are real, and they're not going away. They're not going away because there is a resistance, such a resistance. It's very hard. The confusion again between the church structure type and the institutional church. In our system, for instance, it as a church, it seems to be coming from church traditions. Mm-hmm. And the issue of chairmanship is taken for authority. So if we do not chair and really as authoritatively as possible, then we're losing control. And that makes most of our folks feel very uncomfortable. And you touch on the issue of training. That worries me tremendously. There is so much misunderstanding in many of those places, in spite of the training that was done. In our own system, we've done lots of training. How to address that particular issue of training, since the people we form in our universities, in most cases, are the ones that are going to come and be leaders of the institutions. And at what level do we give them the training for them to lead an institution and deal with board members who, in the best case scenario, will be people informed from the business field out there coming? So we're dealing with potential conflicts right there between the chair, the leaders of some of our institutions, and some board members who can get so frustrated that they may not even want to function. It might not be the same everywhere. The issue of training, are you addressing it? Training of the board, training of leadership, training of whom? Potential leaders coming from our schools, business schools, theology schools, many pastors being named hospital administrators, for instance.
Let me address two things, and then we need to move on. We have set time aside both tomorrow and Friday for discussion, and so please come back and let's dialogue more, because we have 5 or 6 hours just for dialogue in the schedule tomorrow. Ownership. You know, I run an institution for the General Conference. It's a financial institution. We run insurance companies, or we run brokers. That is not a part of the mission of the church, to run an insurance company. The church runs an insurance company to further its mission. It is not the mission to run an insurance company. That is, in many ways, true, maybe not in the same extreme, of hospital, schools, and publishing houses. And when the church, the owner, no longer needs an insurance company to further its mission, they will divest themselves of it. That is going to be very difficult if all of us whose livelihood depends on the institution are sitting on the board of management. There's got to be a distinction between government and ownership and management. And, you know, I'm an American lawyer. I'm arrogant enough to say, you know, I'm here to serve the church, and when they're done with me, I can do just fine somewhere else. Thank you. And you need that. It's horrible arrogance, but you almost need that attitude. You know, I'm here to serve the church, and if I can't serve the church that way, I don't need to be here. As far as training, please join with me in advocating that our seminaries around the world include more management training for our future ministers and leaders. I will invite you back tomorrow and Friday for further discussion on these topics, but we do have one more task today that Dr. Handysides has charged us with, and we need to spend at least a little time on that topic.